Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Rick Harp, host of Media Indigena, joining me again from Winnipeg. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Rick, we are going to talk today about the blockade crackdown. It's not just the protesters who are getting roughed up and thrown in jail. It's reporters, too. And we're going to talk about the Tech Mine pullout. Oh no, the largest tar pit project ever planned is now dead. Who is to blame? The answer will shock you. Good to have you back.
Good to be back.
This episode is brought to everybody by Heather Keim, Ryan Felton, Adrian Diaz, Don Anderson, Rebecca Sheffield, Brian Lamb, Sam Gregory, and Michael Menzel.
My name is Michael Menzel. I'm a retail manager from North Battleford, Saskatchewan, and I support Canada Land because it's the only comprehensive media criticism program in Canada, and the investigative journalism happening on shows like Commons, Thunder Bay, and Cool Mules, you just won't find that anywhere else.
Okay, Rick, last week, the title for our Shortcuts episode was Wet'suwet'en coverage is still pretty bad. I don't know if we should just use that as the rolling title of this show every week, or maybe update it to Wet'suwet'en coverage is now inexcusably shitty. Where do we begin talking about this last week in pipeline protest coverage? Where would you begin?
Oh, well, I think where I might begin is just... And I know this is kind of like media criticism 101, but just the durability of a frame, once it's in place, contradictory facts seem to not really matter. For example, this idea that Canada's in economic chaos, that the economy is collapsing, it's in critical shape because of these blockades. And notwithstanding the fact that there was a pretty decent article, I thought, from the CBC, talking about how CN and CP and the federal government kind of negotiated this diversion plan because they knew something like this might happen, and they responded accordingly. They didn't volunteer the details. And, you know, it's not unlike, for example, the RCMP. When there's a road blockade, they basically divert traffic. They detour it around it. And much the same thing was undertaken here. But the impression was allowed to sort of linger in the air that we're going to have empty store shelves. People are going to freeze to death in their homes and whatnot. And once that frame's in place, frankly, it, again, it's hard to dislodge it. And despite the irony of there being, I feel, an unprecedented abundance of information sources, doesn't seem to matter. Once somebody gets out of that gate first with an impression, you know, an allegation, everyone else is playing catch up, including the facts.
You know what? That's a great place to start, because I will confess, I got this email from a listener saying, hey, I the media has given me the idea that there's like a complete rail paralysis, like the blockade has just shut down rail traffic throughout Canada entirely. And I don't think that's true. And I tweeted that out. I said, hey, is there really a rail stoppage, like a complete rail shutdown in Canada? And people were tweeting me like, no, not where I live. And people just started sharing photos of freight trains just running overdrive, because, of course, now that they've diverted traffic from the routes that were blocked, there's tons of traffic on these other routes. And Rick, I got to tell you, I got mocked pretty, you know, roundly from journalists saying, Jesse, nobody was reporting that there was a complete Canada-wide rail blockage. And James McLeod from Post Media is like, oh, Jesse Brown is now a trains truther. And another Post Media reporter, Tyler Dawson, said, I don't know that there's anyone who has said there's a countrywide shutdown. And I was feeling pretty foolish. And then I read Forbes magazine reporting complete rail paralysis throughout Canada. The Globe and Mail on Wednesday reporting Mohawk protesters ground the country's rail traffic to a stop.
Yeah.
So I do not think that I'm the only one who accepted that frame. I think that when people read blockade, 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 and then you read more media coverage about how it's only a matter of days before we can't even get the necessary chemicals to get like drinking water to work in Canada, which is hilarious for other reasons, you know. But I think that there was, the media spread an idea that, hey, maybe there's sympathy out there for Indigenous protesters up to a point, but they are about to stop the entire economy because they have completely shut down rail traffic. And that simply was never true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's this kind of cartoonishly fake outrage that continues to, you know, work in binaries. On the one hand, we have innocent Canadians, on the other, villainous radicals on the other, blocking every single track that ever existed in Canada. And you know, once in a while, there's sort of a cover by sticking in a line or two well below, you know, the main lead paragraphs as kind of a sort of an ass covering move by journalists. But again, I think the problem is once you go down the path of villainy, that is to say, that is how you construct your story metaphorically in terms of its frames. It's almost like there's no turning back on that. Now, again, we can get into an endless debate about, well, is this what the audiences have been trained to expect? Can we entirely fault media that's utterly bound up in trying to attract and truck in attention? I don't know. We're not going to resolve that today, but I think
that's... It's chicken and egg stuff, I guess, you know? And the people who make the media are also consumers of media who have those, you know, tropes within their heads. Some of it is unintentional, but it gets into the coverage. You know, like there's been this whole focus on, like, you know, who are these hereditary chiefs really? And, any dissenting voice gets, like, their own profile. And the Globe and Mail, they did two profiles of Wet'suwet'en, you know, various chiefs and members of the community who are not, like, the top hereditary chiefs who actually support the project. And they profiled Gary Naziel, who is a Lac-Seul-Yu wing chief, about how he's actually really for this project. And they do not mention that he is currently subcontracted by CGL and has worked for them he's employed by the pipeline.
No conflict of interest there, eh?
It's hard not to ascribe intentionality. Like, it seems like the media is trying to sow divisions and delegitimize. Like, it's just a handful. It's just these five chiefs who are making all this trouble. Should they really be allowed to hold the whole country hostage? So, you know, like, that's part of the frame as well.
Yeah, yeah. Another sort of frame of reference is just Canada continues to be divided today. I hear that in the intro of various news outlets. And again, it just seems to be like crack to media. If you can find any way to frame something as divisive and as, you know, tearing the country apart. I mean, we used to have the two solitudes. And frankly, to me, maybe that is apt, but it's not apt in the way that they think. It occurred to me that there are two solitudes, but they're the kind that I would define as upstream and downstream. And those who are downstream of all the pollution and all the effects of climate change, those are mostly Indigenous people who've been sort of relegated to sacrifice zones for Canada's prosperity. And then you have upstream, which, you know, at the immediate upstream, I mean, those who immediately profit from resource extraction through jobs, and then you go further upstream, you have the corporations who are raking in billions of dollars of profit. But that's not, of course, what we mean by divided. In the media, it's usually hardworking Canadians and then these radicals on the rails.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about that, because that's another thing that I think the media has played actually a divisive and misinforming role in that, you know, you get like, I think maybe one, maybe there were two instances of Yahoos in pickup trucks going and disassembling the blockades.
Right.
It was, they heaped coverage on these guys who were confronting the protesters. And, you know, for all this fear of these angry Indigenous protesters, these are remarkably peaceful protests. I don't think that there's any of these things have devolved into fisticuffs. But so these guys show up and they take down the blockades. It gets covered. And then Peter McKay comes in and says, good on ya.
Yeah.
You know, this is fantastic. And then, you know, he walks that back and then that gets covered. And then the rebel comes in and says, these Canadian patriots are doing what Trudeau's, you know, wussy cops are not allowed to do. If any of them get arrested by the Trudeau state, we will cover their legal fees, right? So what you get out of that is you create an idea, which I do not think is actually accurate, that basically we're heading towards blood on the tracks. That this situation, you know, Trudeau has taken a position of like patience, reconciliation, but, you know, that's just a vacuum of leadership. And into that vacuum, we're going to have anarchy pretty soon. And I think that is what sets the stage for what happens next. I mean, the media has fed into this idea that there's like going to be a race war on the train tracks. And, you know, when you're trying to explain Trudeau's complete about face, whereas just, you know, weeks ago he was saying, we're going to have negotiations, we're going to talk, this is a time for patience. And now he said, well, I've got no more patience. The other side isn't even showing up to the negotiating table. It's time to start, like, you've got till midnight. And then, it's, you know, and then we're going to start cracking heads is the implied threat. So where did that come from? I think that comes from a growing public sense that we can't stand for this. The economy is about to be paralyzed if it's not paralyzed already. And we're heading towards, absolute violence because we have no leadership. And then he feels like he has to do something about this. So the media, I think, has played a very real role in shaping the outcomes here. And like, it's just filled with holes in the coverage, vacuums of information and misrepresentation.
I couldn't agree more.
I will go on, Rick. I'm worked up because when I look at this in its totality, I feel like this is a media failure in a really consequential way. It's getting me angry. But I just want to, like, let me kind of step back from my rage and just look at this as a curious newsreader.
Yeah.
Because when Trudeau says that there's this negotiation, like the other side's not showing up to the table, I just want to get like a narrative straight, you know, because that's not what I thought was happening. What I thought was happening was that the hereditary chiefs of Wet'suwet'en were saying, we want the RCMP out of Wet'suwet'en territory. And that starts with getting them immediately away from these raids on the camps at Unist'ot'en, but we don't want them patrolling either. And the government says, or the actions of the RCMP are that they withdraw from the camps, but they do not withdraw from Wet'suwet'en territory. They continue to patrol. They don't meet the demands. And therefore, the blockades don't come down.
Yeah.
Right? So who walked away from that negotiation? Like, it would seem to me that it's the government that for some reason was unable to fully withdraw, whether there's conversation about whether the PMO can call the RCMP off if they wanted to, but whatever, obviously that is what's being negotiated and RCMP are not willing to fully withdraw. And then Trudeau claims that the other side is the unreasonable one, that there's no one there to talk to. Now, what I'm lacking in the coverage is I am not aware that the Prime Minister has explained why the RCMP must continue to patrol and why that's not negotiable. And I am not aware of a reporter asking him.
Right.
I just don't see in the reporting that there's a record of their position. So before we even get to, oh, is the media sympathetic? Are they critical? I don't know that they even have created a public record of the rationale because nobody's asked.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like the claims, the allegations that Canada's economy has been crippled by these blockades, there seems to be a lack of curiosity and scrutiny to these claims. And so it is with the federal government's supposed efforts to negotiate. And in some ways, I just sort of feel like there was either an unstated or a specifically calculated move to kind of, well, let's just wait a certain amount of time that it makes it look like we've invested some effort and some goodwill. And after such time, we can say, well, we tried our best, but we've got these intransigent folks. We have no choice. Our hands are tied. And something else I want to talk about in terms of the media role, I thought Kenneth Jackson from APTN News, where I continue to be employed, so I guess I'm a booster of our own reportage. But in any case, there was a story he did on the 19th called How CN Rail Got Its Injunction Against Tyendinaga Mohawks. Mm-hmm. And it's worth reading. But basically, it seems that CN Rail and the presiding judge based all their evidence on media reportage.
Uh-huh.
And none of which seemed to show anybody on the tracks. Now, I know, of course, some people are going to say, well, that's a distinction without a difference. They were immediately adjacent to the tracks. But in any case, it's quite something that, you know, what's being relied upon as evidence is strictly media. And of course, to the extent that the media has not done a fulsome job, as we've been discussing, that has repercussions, obviously, in the legal context.
Yeah, it's a whole other layer to it. If the best account you have is the media account, and the media, in many cases, isn't even there. You know, last week, we told you about the RCMP detaining reporters in Wet'suwet'en who were trying to document the raids, where, you know, like, they didn't arrest them. They just, like, kind of put them in the, they told them they couldn't be there. There was a media exclusion zone. They put them in the car and just dropped them off in a parking lot. I think they later apologized. You know, they said that some officers were overstepping. There was confusion. This week, I can tell you that Melissa Cox, a documentary filmmaker who was covering the arrest of a chief in Gitxsan territory, which is not far from Wet'suwet'en, she was not just detained, but arrested and kind of violently roughed up, as the account goes, by the RCMP. They threw her camera to the ground. They apparently were messing with the camera. I don't know if they were deleting the footage or what. They locked her up for hours. So there was an arrest made. There was a detention. They release her. They haven't charged her. This is shameful shit. Like, what's happening with the press? Like, we can't see what's going on because media are being kept at bay. And the only media who are trying to get very close to the action are, it seems, the independent media. The big legacy brands, either they are unable to invest to have people, like, basically camp out with protesters for like a month, which is how some of these people in Wet'suwet'en got access. And then here in Tyendinaga, the OPP kept media in this, like, exclusion zone, like, very far from the action when it finally came time to make arrests after the protesters did not observe the midnight deadline earlier this week. So how did we get this footage of, like, five or six, like, heavily armed officers descending on a couple of protesters? And when force is used, we got really, really gripping and disturbing footage of how much force was used. We didn't get it from all the reporters who observed that line. We got it from something I actually was unaware of, Real People's Media. That was the website that posted this video. And who are Real People's Media? Well, the Globe and Mail finally, gives some attention towards independent Indigenous media in this really derisive profile of Real People's Media, which is basically casting aspersions on them because they are protesters and covering the protest, which is, you know, that there's tension there and conflict there that I would be quick to point out as a media critic myself. Mm-hmm. But I think that the article really was delegitimizing this outfit without a couple of important things being mentioned. One is that every advocacy group in existence has their own kind of communications wing where they try to document what's going on and tell the story from their point of view. There's no real unique aspect here, but also the irony of this and the fact of it is that in Canada right now, if you want to document and do journalism and report on the conflict between police and protesters, you have to be a protester because reporters aren't allowed to be close enough to see that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the same type of folks who were complaining about being journalists not having access to the BC legislature in Victoria, I mean, where's their umbrage with regard to the RCMP keeping media away. And if the media want to dump on real people's media for the reasons you laid out, well, then go into the cover the fray yourself. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know what the mood was like. Why did none of the, as you call them, legacy media decide to push it?
Yeah. There's sort of crimes of omission and negligence and laziness. There's sort of bad media that can happen because you don't have the resources. And then there's the cumulative effect of that, which without anyone seeking to do damage can really be consequential. And I think that that played a big role in creating this frame, as you put it, which led to a decision from the top to crack down, which is now having reverberations, you know, and all of the it's not going to work. We're already seeing how many more protests and blockades that's inspiring. But I don't let them off the hook entirely. We'll continue to name names because some of this coverage that we're seeing, it feels intentional. It's not simply people with sort of unchecked bias or just dealing with a lack of resources. When you elevate some voices, you try to create division and dissent within communities. When you try to delegitimize, I hate to even say his name, but the National Post is still publishing Jonathan Kay. And Jonathan Kay has this trope where he's like continuing to refer to the hereditary chiefs as hereditary dudes or these hereditary guys. And he's sort of openly mocking and dismissing, like, what kind of, like, you know, the implication is, like, it's not even implied. Like I've seen him just say this outright. Like, what kind of a backward system do you get power based on who your dad was? John Kay fucking wrote Justin Trudeau's memoir. He ghost wrote that. You don't get to shit on hereditary political leadership in Trudeau's Canada. You don't get to. I don't excuse it.
Well, does Jonathan Kay's career go anywhere without Barbara Kay? I mean, it's an honest question. I'm not trying to be a dick here, but if we want to talk about hereditary...
here we are again. Yeah.
Casting aspersions on hereditary connections. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm honestly just putting it out there.
It's just baffling.
I mean, come on. If there's no Pierre Trudeau, I think there's a decent argument to be had that there's no Justin Trudeau. If we don't have Rob Ford, we don't have Doug Ford. You guys just did a series on dynasties, right? I mean, on how family privilege is passed on or passed laterally. It's again, this is the kind of larger contextual thinking that just seems to evacuate from reporters' brains when they want to just, you know, go with the immediate heat of the situation. And I just think this lust for heat is, I don't know, again, this is the core contradiction of media, I suppose. They're there to inform, but they're also there to inflame. And I don't know how you resolve that contradiction. It's about as hard as resolving the contradiction between climate justice and economic development, which I'm sure we'll get into soon.
Okay, Rick, on Duly Noted, we try to shed a little bit more light on things that need a little bit more light that maybe would otherwise go overlooked, or just things that we like and want more people to know about. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I have quite a remarkable statement by a longtime CBC columnist, and I'm talking about Jesse Wente, who has appeared for a couple decades on Metro Morning, the flagship morning program of CBC Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And in just a blistering, righteous column, basically he declares reconciliation is dead and it was never really alive. If you haven't heard it, you can easily access it on the CBC website. He also talks about how, quote, Canada
is a state built on the removal of Indigenous peoples to make way for resource extraction companies. That's very literally the reason this country exists.
Canada is a state built on removal of Indigenous peoples. That's quite the comment on the state broadcaster.
Rick, I heard Jesse Wente delivering that column and like my house, just everybody stopped what they were doing. It's just, there are moments in radio where just something has just immediacy and urgency and the ring of truth. Like he's saying things that are politically radical, considered so. And yet like, if you actually take that apart that's actually just historically true. Like that's, you know, we're sort of here to, you know, help British Empire make hats before anything else. There was just the emotion in his voice, but the power of what he was saying and the fact that he was saying it on the CBC was remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that he's doing it in his position in a major Canadian market, very close to the populations that are affected by these blockades. I mean, I think he's probably the only Indigenous person at the CBC who could do that. Now, he's not an employee of the CBC, so it's important to make that distinction. Nonetheless, I don't know of any other Indigenous person who's regularly appears on the airwaves of CBC could do that. I'm tempted to say get away with that. I used to work with the CBC, and there's hell no would I ever even think of going there.
Absolutely not. No other voice. Nobody from CBC Indigenous, nobody could say that and keep their job. I mean, that was Jesse Wente, I think, exerting the moral authority that he earned.
Exactly, exactly.
Duly noted, it's supposed to be a short segment, but I have to ask you, do you agree with him? The last time we had a headline that had something to do suggesting that reconciliation is compromised or dead, I heard pushback from Indigenous voices who are deeply invested in this concept of reconciliation. I'm just wondering what your take on that was, if that's possible to synopsize.
Well, you know, reconciliation is slippery. It's one of these terms that can do a lot of work. often it's used as cover to make it appear as if something's actually being done. To me, reconciliation is about reparation. It's about restoration. It's about identifying that which was taken away, whether it's land or language. I mean, these are things that can be restored, right? You can never restore the broken relationship between a parent whose children were seized at age 5 and taken into residential school. But that's how I define it, and that's drawing on the wisdom of Tanya Tagaq. So that which was taken away, the problem creates the parameters of the solution, and I don't see anything even close to that. So, reconciliation is dead. Like Jesse, I agree. It was never really alive.
Duly noted. To wit, I have a duly noted to share, which is...
All right.
A cartoon that Ryan McMahon brought to my attention that was published in the midst of all of this in the Calgary Herald. Maybe it was within a few days before Jesse Wente shocked us by saying such things on the CBC. And you say, wow, if you can say things like that on the CBC, maybe there is a hope for the media in Canada. And then the same week, a syndicated cartoon ran in the Calgary Herald. This wasn't anything that anyone at Post Media wrote or drew. They who even knows in this day and age if they even have a human to look at their funny pages to make sure that something like this doesn't get published. But published it was. And the cartoon is a syndicated comic I was previously unaware of called Close to Home. And there's a very shitty drawing of the Lone Ranger and Tonto at a bar. And Tonto is just drawn in this like bug-eyed, red-skinned, just absolute racist propaganda caricature, and he's drunk, slumped over at the bar with his ear on the wooden bar as if it was a railway track, and he's saying, "Kimosabi, Tonto here, last call coming, maybe 8 or 10 minutes away." So that's the funny pages during reconciliation in Canada. Post Media apologized. They canceled the comic strip. They were quick to point out this is a syndicated comic strip. And I'm sure that Post Media employees, there's a lot of reporters I respect there who it bothers them, the association of Post Media with racism. It bothers them that they have to go to dinner parties or meet friends and answer for the things that Post Media has published when they're just trying to do their jobs. And they're quick to let me know, like, do you think that that's what we do is sit around twirling our mustaches and planning the next racist cartoon? and I feel for them. I feel for them as journalists who still have jobs and want to keep them. But, like, you can't step in dog shit 10 steps in a row and keep calling it an accident.
Right.
Because I remember the anti-immigrant column that they had to apologize for out in Vancouver. And I remember Sue Ann Levy's column about goat slaughtering. Like it goes on. I remember the anti-Semitic cartoons that they recently, like it doesn't happen to other people again and again and again. And so, or, you know, maybe it does, but it happens to post media more than anyone else. And I will note it every time.
Yeah, I think it's proof that the National Post doesn't read their comic section either. But be that as it may, you know, the question of the relevance of comic strips and newspapers. Yeah, it's at the same time, it's in your paper. So you better damn well own it. Its timing is both unfortunate, but also telling, I think, in a lot of ways, too. Duly noted, sir.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Okay, Rick. So this is bad news for the Alberta economy. This was a shocker to a lot of people. That the biggest oil sands project ever planned, a project that was on track to, you know, create thousands of jobs, that had sign-ons from Indigenous leadership, the tech mine, tech pulled out. And instantly, it was a blame game as to why this happened. And I'm trying to follow this, and I'm reading, you know, Alberta's premier, Jason Kenney, he blamed this basically on the protests, on a general atmosphere of lawlessness. In the National Post, I read the $20 billion frontier mine shelved amid escalating rail blockades. A direct connection is being drawn there. And as the conversation progressed, it became this debate as to, like, well, what really did it in? Can you blame it on the protesters, or do you blame this on Trudeau? I remember reading that it was because of Canada's basket case regulatory framework. We just, you know, our policies, we have bad leadership, and it's the Trudeau government that is just creating so much uncertainty amongst investors that projects like this sends a terrible message, and we can expect no further investment in Canada after this project was pulled. Rick, mm-hmm. Separate from me trying to understand and get to my own opinion with this information as to why this happened, I'm not even thinking about Canada. I am listening to The Daily, the New York Times podcast, right? And I happen to listen to this episode, which is talking about, you know, like the thing that first got my attention was that, you know, Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world, has dedicated $10 billion to fighting climate change. And so they do an episode where they dig into why not only Jeff Bezos, but why all of these major, major corporations in America are suddenly going green, and why Delta Airlines has made this big announcement that they're going carbon neutral, and Microsoft, and on and on. And it's this fascinating story. I don't really follow financial stuff as well as I should, but what I learned was this guy I didn't know about before, Larry Fink, who controls BlackRock. BlackRock, which is the biggest investor in the world. They have $7 trillion. Like, this guy decides we're $7 trillion. I can't even conceive of $1 trillion. This guy has seven of them. What he does is every year he writes an email that goes out to all the CEOs where he basically says, this is what we're investing in and this is what's important. And he has just this like incredible power to shape corporate, not just America, but the world. And part of that is that he sets the trend, but part of it is that he directly controls this an incredible amount of resource. And so I was wondering, like, wow, how come I'm reading in isolation from this greater corporate shift towards carbon neutral investments, and then I'm reading about this tech thing as if it's just about like indigenous protesters or Trudeau policy? BlackRock is the top investor in tech.
Hey, this is Jesse here, interrupting myself to say that we caught an error in our show after recording it. BlackRock is a top investor in tech. They're not the top investor. To be exact, it is the third largest shareholder, according to the Financial Post. Okay, back to the show.
I was just shocked to learn that we're having this media discussion in Canada that is just, I don't know that I've heard Fink or BlackRock mentioned in the avalanche of coverage around who in Canada is to blame for this tech mine pullout.
Yeah, no, this is news to me. From what I understand, there are people connected to BlackRock who are connected to Justin Trudeau and that don't play a small part in giving advice on what the Liberals may or may not want to do economically. So there's a tight relationship there with various economic elites and political elites. So yeah, it's very much a germane thing to reference.
You get into this thing where you've got Jason Kenney in his war room, and it's like this weird, almost like narcissistic thing, like the world's out to get Alberta. Like, the world doesn't care about Alberta. Like in the world right now, we're moving past this point where you can kind of like use PR, like ethical oil or cuddly coal. The corporate world is moving away from the kind of investments that Canada is deeply, deeply dependent on, you know, and that's a bitter pill to swallow, especially for Alberta, but for the whole country. And it is alarming to me how poorly served we are in our information diet, that we have allowed ourselves, I think, to kind of be like isolated on this like a Galapagos island of information where we're just sort of like trading insults at each other and really scapegoating Indigenous protesters for like somehow playing a role.
Well, I mean, in some of the better reportage I've seen from places like the National Observer, they talked about how another project, the Fort Hills project, which is connected to the oil sands, tech wrote down some losses from that. And that to me would also seem kind of pertinent for mapping out the terrain of what may or may not have informed its decision making. But again, the media is more excited and finds more sexy the Kenny versus Trudeau type of battle. I think, you know, low information, so-called low context audiences are at the mercy of that type of reportage. And other interesting context might be how, frankly, I don't think it's a debate, but let's say it's worth a debate as to what extent state intervention made the oil sands possible in the first place.
Right, right.
So, you know, this sort of interplay between private and public actors, you know, some people might see that as kind of wonky and whatnot, but in this case, not at all. So if the state can lead a province and by extension, a big part of Canada into this particular form of economic development, well, it could lead it out as well. And so Gramsci talked about an interregnum. You know, the old era is dying while the new one's being formed, and we're sort of in the messy middle. I guess this is what it looks like in the headlines of major newspapers.
That's a deep cut. Gramsci on shortcuts.
You know what? I've been using that a lot lately. It's getting tired now. Sorry.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this, just as an Indigenous person and one who is very media-minded and keeping a close eye on this. The focusing of so much of the news and the consequences for the future of this country, and I think in many cases incorrectly, got it like with this tech mind thing, on the shoulders of Indigenous people has consequences. And I'm reading tweets from people who moderate comments saying, I just had to remove 100 death threats against Indigenous people my news company's website. And, you know, like the button that is getting pressed here, and it's just, I'm getting whiplash from how quickly Canada has gone from this kind of like conciliatory or reconciliatory, you know, very warm and fuzzy posture to just the fangs are being bared here, and it's ugly. And I wonder what that's like from your perspective, and if you're noticing this too.
Well, you know, I've been in a mild state of anxiety this week, you know, preparing for this podcast, because, you know, I've had to watch the footage, and, you know, if it wouldn't cost too much money to replace it, I would have thrown stuff at the TV repeatedly, because I'm just all these different, like you say, sins of omission and commission when it comes to trying to tell the story. I can just see how all of these gaps or all of these misleading tropes and frames are going to be weaponized. And in fact, I mean, these tropes don't just emerge organically. I mean, there's all sorts of spin going on and vested interests in seeing these projects go ahead. And when they're thwarted, you know, that makes some people angry. And to see us, to see Indigenous peoples scapegoated for this, when again, I made that distinction between upstream and downstream parts of what is currently called Canada, it is an infinitesimal minority of Indigenous peoples who've benefited from resource development. And in fact, our depopulation, our displacement, and our disappearance were, as Jesse Wente rightly pointed out, were the necessary preconditions for these things to happen. And so it shouldn't be a mystery why there's pushback. The mystery should be why didn't it come sooner? But all of that is eviscerated. All of that is absent. I know there's only so much time in a given report, but I worry. I don't know where this is going to go, but to blame those who've been primarily victimized by the operations of resource development for its downfall, well, it's very convenient, but it's also... It's pretty shitty. Can I just say one more thing, though? Just one more thing. Something that gets thrown around a lot, quite often without, you know, anyone having to explain it, are these notions of economic realities and political realities. And I really want to see the media take ownership over the climate realities, because I honestly think the first two are very much open to dispute. They're very much open to manipulation. The climate ostensibly is not. And I think in some ways, all the things we've talked about today, they are what happen when you have a media that has no capacity to understand the climate. I mean, it's only recently that they finally let go of this idea. Well, there's a debate. The science is not settled. And as far as I'm concerned, what are the costs of being wrong in terms of the climate, you know, misunderstanding the climate? If you understand it in the direction of less carbon, to me that doesn't seem quite nearly as consequential as the opposite. It's a rant, I apologize, but I'm still trying to articulate what a new set of ethics and values and protocols and procedures would be in an era of existential climate crisis. But holy shit, man, like if we're not going to respond as the institution entrusted with telling the truth and helping us make decisions about our lives, who the F else are we going to turn to? Anyway, end of rant.
That is your Canada Land Shortcuts. You can email me about it at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I do read everything that you send. And listen, if you want to support us and get ad-free versions of this show, and we need you to, and we want you to, it's just $5 per month, Canadian. It's never been easier to do that when you click on the link in the episode notes, or just go to canadalandshow.com/join, and it just goes bloop and puts the premium gold-plated Canada Land ad-free feed onto your app or desktop. We are on Twitter @CanadaLand. Rick Harp, where can people find you? Where can they find your podcast?
They can find Media Indigena on Twitter, Media Indigena, I-N-D-I-G-E-N-A, and MediaIndigena.com.
Our website is at CanadaLandShow.com. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at CFUV.ca.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.